Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Hi, America, and other places that I presume exist but cannot currently prove the reality of. This is the worst year ever, as you're aware of, because you're living through it. And I am Robert Evans, here today with my co-host, Cody.
Katie Stoll.
Yep, there we go.
Cody.Katie.
Cody.Katie.
Stoll.Kate. Hey, guys.
I would have
guys.
Assumed you'd both be .orgs.
I am not. I did not register myself as an org.
Oh, you better not have done with .us, because that's a real pain in the ass.
I don't like when people are .co. I don't
.co?
Like that.
Yeah.
What
even
is that?
Cody.co. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a
Cody.
Thing.
Oh,
that
would be
works
good,
for
actually.
Cody.
Oh, and you could be, if you move to Canada, you could be Katie.ca.
Done.
Oh, I like that.
I'd love to move to Canada.
Yeah.
Actually, right now I'm thinking Denmark looks good.
Denmark's looking good. Did a really good job of handling their coronavirus outbreak? Gaza,
Germany?
Apparently.
Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, yes, a number of places that aren't where we live did
really?
Good jobs in very different tactics. Yeah, seems like they got a handle on it.
So I know
speaking
that...
Speaking of open-air prisons, yeah?
Well
we
actually
had not...
does tie in.
We had not introduced the subject of this week's episode, but Cody, thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
There we go.
Speaking of prisons.
Cody's intro was the best that's ever been done, FYI.
Yeah. That was
speaking,
a complete accident. Yeah.
Speaking of prisons, let's all stop saying that our homes are like a prison, because that is not fair to prisons or doing justice to the situation, which we were going to talk about today.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm always, whenever I hear that, I'm always reminded of, I apologize to listeners, that one episode of The Office where they had like a prisoner work program.
Yes.
And everyone was referring to The Office as a prison, and Michael Scott was like, no, it's actually good, see? And everyone's like, yeah, obviously. Obviously it's not like prison.
Yes. Although I will say are the current terms that under which many Americans, including ourselves, are social distancing, if you were going to compare it to a prison, you might compare it to the kind of prison that people go to after they steal billions of dollars and cause tens of thousands of people to lose their homes like that. It's like white collar crime prison. It's broadly
like
that.
It's like Jeffrey Epstein prison.
Well, no.
No. The first time around, he went to a cushy prison place where he was allowed out every day to go to work.
Yeah. We're all experiencing something that's like broadly similar to how Jeffrey Epstein was incarcerated the first time. Yes, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, I love
you.
Go to work. My experience is to, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that the end of the episode? Are we done now?
Yeah, we're done. We've hit it. No.
So, speaking of open air prisons, Jeffrey Epstein. Is that that was the episode?
Yes. Yeah. This was all part of our goal of tying Jeffrey Epstein's first incarceration to the lockdown of Gaza for reasons that I think have escaped us all and never made much sense to begin with and were always a bad idea. Thank you for listening.
Yep. Goodbye.
In conclusion, goodbye. No.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Go, Robert, you go.
Are we going to start the episode now?
Yeah, I'll start.
Boy.
I'll go, because I think my section should probably be first, because it's about, okay.
Yeah.
Hold on. All right.
So, just for listeners' sake, none of us are doing great with the quarantine today, the Monday that we're recording this, and so starting this episode's a little bit of a shit show, because I think, I don't want to speak for everyone else, but this is also me starting my week, and it's not going great.
It's definitely the beginning of a new week, and we're all doing our best.
Yeah, which is not very good.
It doesn't sound like it's great today. So obviously, as I'm sure at least the title has indicated, we certainly have not, the hosts of the show, But we're going to talk about prisons today and this week. We have an interview later this week as well on this topic. Because if you've been reading the news, which for that I am sorry if you have been, there's a lot of COVID cases in prisons, and a lot of discussion about what to do about that, and protests going on. We'll get into all of it, but just generally, and like I won't get into the conditions of prisons in general. I think listeners and hosts and everybody probably know it's not great. Good guess. Good guess would be not great. But just in terms of this pandemic and the things that we all need to do, like social distancing, the inmate population in federal prisons exceeds their rated capacity by 12 to 19%.
Yeah. If I can quickly interject, I found a startling statistic. So California has a really bad problem with coronavirus in its prisons. 10 years ago, a federal court ordered the state to reduce its inmate population, and they were required to reduce it to less than 137.5% of capacity. So they were above 135.7% capacity of their prisons. There are today 114,000 people housed in California's main prisons, which were designed to support 85,000 people. So just
not
like.
Great.
And that's, as Cody's saying, that's a nationwide thing. I just picked California because it's kind of like the starkest example. But that's like, say, your local concert hall is supposed to fit 300 people and they fit 500 people in there. You're not going to be happy about that for a variety of reasons.
And I actually do think it's maybe a good idea just to quickly say some of the things that are wrong with prisons in general, even outside of coronavirus,
or their existence.
Leads to their existence, sure. Yeah. And that's a whole conversation as well. But, it's not cleanly. It's not safe. They, as you mentioned, overcrowding of prisons is a real epidemic and it's a real problem. And there's a lot of social issues and reasons why it is that way. But it's impossible for prisoners to keep distance from each other. It's impossible to even maintain a bare minimum of cleanliness that is required to survive this pandemic. They don't have access to water like we do, or soap.
Yeah, they aren't allowed to have antibacterial soap because there's alcohol in it, and so they could drink it. So that was an initial problem. Another major problem is that nationwide, an estimated 40% of incarcerated people in jails and prisons have at least one chronic medical condition, which renders them significantly more vulnerable to COVID-19. Thanks for participating, by the way, Katie, in this long hijacking of Cody's train of thought. We should return things to Cody now.
I mean, it's all nested in the whole point, which is that even if, let's say even capacity was down and at 100%, that's not good.
That's not ideal, no. For the same reason no one likes to be on a full plane flight.
Right. This wouldn't be an ideal situation to implement any of these things anyway. Yeah, it just so happens that it's much worse than that.
Yeah, if the problem were 40% less bad than it is, it would be a real problem.
Right.
Cool. Okay.
Very cool. Yeah, it's just it's happening everywhere. In counties, you'll see here are all of these reported cases in this county. Like Brazoria County in Texas, 27 cases were reported. 25 of those were from their facility. It's just over and over. Last week, though, the majority of inmates hadn't been tested in Cook County Jail in Chicago. Even though the majority had not been tested, they still had 230 inmates and 115 staff members testing positive.
Awesome.
In Ohio, the Marion Correctional Institution had 2,011 inmates testing positive, which is 80% of their prison population. Again, speaking of staff, 154 of 350 staff tested positive. And also NPR reported that these tests where 2011 inmates were testing positive, they didn't even get to see the results of their tests. The tests were done and they found out, oh, this many prisoners here are testing positive, but the individuals did not get informed of whether or not they tested positive. which makes all of the things that we need to do harder. Again, wouldn't have been easy, but they made it harder. There's a low security prison in San Pedro called Terminal Island. And
cute name.
Cute name. A great name for the current situation. Terminal Island. My God. 693 of its 1,042 inmates, 67% of their prison are testing positive. And just
2%
I could go
short of being nice.
Nice. Yeah. Really close to being nice. But it's just case after case of this kind of thing.
Yeah, and there's the speaking of like fuck ups in prisons, there was just like Michigan has the highest death rate of any state in terms of like prisoners dying of COVID-19, and a story just dropped a few days ago that three inmates who were infected were sent to one of Michigan's prisons that had no coronavirus cases just because of a fuck up in testing, which
cool.
is great.
Yeah. I laughed, but it wasn't full of mirth or joy.
Love
no.
it.
Yeah,
and yeah, like you were alluding to, like a lot of the you know, a lot of prisoners have pre-existing conditions and certain extreme cases. There's what Federal Medical Center in Fort Worth, which is where a lot of them go. They're at 620 cases there out of 1,463 people. It's because of the conditions of not only the facilities, but also of the inmates there. And so it's just, there's so many everywhere, and it's clearly a problem
yeah.
at these kinds of places specifically. And they're, you know, prisons, we all know, co-hosts and listeners, everybody, of the problems with prisons in general. We've talked about it on the show. But there are just so many people there that are elderly, that have these conditions and problems that have been in prison for decades and probably don't need to be there anymore. Like, there's a study from the Brennan Center for Justice that found no compelling public safety reason to incarcerate 39% of the inmates in state and federal prisons, which is about 576,000 people. Elderly Americans are especially unlikely to commit further crimes once released. The United States yeah. Sentencing Commission found in 2017 that offenders over the age of 65 had just a 13.4% chance of being rearrested in an 8-year period after release, compared to a 67.6% chance for those under age 21. So these are people who've been in prison for decades and decades for things, you know, ranging from, it could be a violent offense, it could be, like, a tax thing, it could be any, like, having, like, a little bit of weed on them, who knows. But they're over 65, and if you release them into the public to get them out of this situation, that they're not in there for this. They're not in there to die of this virus. Then
and it's
yeah. not like an immense threat to public safety to release them.
And it's very frustrating because if you try to lay out the actual facts of incarceration in America, you wind up. One of the arguments you'll hear for people who will complain about how many people are incarcerated is the number of nonviolent drug offenders, and that is a problem. But the reality of the situation is that most people who are incarcerated in the United States for long sentences have committed some sort of violent crime. The numbers are that about 55% of federal inmates, somewhere around there, a little over half. Are on some sort of drug offense, but that's about 10% of the incarcerated total. And more than half of people who are incarcerated in state prisons have some sort of violent offense. Now, that's even more complicated than it sounds for a number of reasons. One of them is that when you, like, the data that we have that determines, like, whether or not somebody's, you know, doing time for a violent or a nonviolent offense, it is based on what is marked down as their most severe charge. So in a lot of cases, that means that someone who has domestic violence and a heroin charge might look like a nonviolent heroin offender, even though, no, that's a person who actually did commit a violent crime. It's just that our system considered the heroin crime to be a more severe crime. The second factor in that, though, is that a lot of people who commit crimes like robbery and burglary that may not have involved a violent crime but are mm-hmm. considered violent crimes get written down as violent criminals. But the broader issue is that this leads to a situation wherein a lot of Americans, if they find out someone has a violent crime in their history, period, then they suddenly have no desire in, you know, a lot of Americans have gotten on board the idea that, like, drug offenders should be let out. And consistently, when people are asked to estimate what percentage of the prison population are nonviolent drug offenders, they vastly overestimate how many Americans are just in prison for a drug offense. But when... And so when people find out, like so when you've looked at the way governors have approached talking about releasing, because like in New York and in California and in Michigan and a number of states, Washington, you have had governors releasing at least temporarily nonviolent offenders. But they all point out that they don't want to release violent offenders and that this will not affect violent offenders. And as Cody notes, for one thing, it is incredibly unlikely for elderly offenders to reoffend. It very, very rarely happens.
Just to interject, like, isn't that the point? Like,
yeah, it should be. Yes.
Like, that people emerge rehabilitated.
Like, reformative, like, restorative justice, like, people, I don't know.
It should be the point.
It should be the point.
And it's this, we have this difficulty. So there's another study I was reading about where they asked people to imagine one of their relatives, a loved one, a family member, was murdered, and what sentence they think would be effective, would be fair for the murderer. And people pick, obviously, very, very harsh sentences. They want the book thrown at the person who took their loved one away from them, which, of course, makes sense. But when people are asked to imagine that a loved one committed one of those crimes, they consider the recommended sentence to be considerably more lenient. Because when we think about people we care about, it's easier to imagine, even if they did something horrible, we can imagine them redeeming themselves because we see them as complete human beings who may have done something terrible but aren't washed out. And so, like, this is part of the complexity of communicating the issues that we're having with incarceration to people. I found a really interesting article in a Washington conservative radio jock kind of piece of shit, Jason Rantz, who was complaining that Governor Inslee had released about 1,000 prisoners, which was not a lot of prisoners. So this guy was pointing out that, like, well, we said on the right when they said, you know, we conservatives said that when they started releasing prisoners, it was going to go bad. And sure enough, just a couple of weeks after he released these prisoners, you know, a bunch of them have reoffended. And then you get through the article and it turns out that 3 people have reoffended. And the 3 reoffenses out of that 1,000.
What's the legal definition of a bunch?
Yeah. Yeah, he says that, it's very frustrating. So, and the 3 offenses are, one person, like, went on a high-speed chase and was charged with a felony count of eluding police and 2 misdemeanor charges of obstructing an officer and driving with a suspended license. No violent crimes, no one hurt, nothing stolen.
I wonder when he could have renewed his license.
Yeah, exactly.
In the time that he's been out. I wonder why he ran away from the cops that he's afraid of.
Yeah, it's frustrating. Another person had gotten high on methamphetamines and used a crowbar to break wooden boards that were, like, had been boarded up over a window. Like, he was just, like, fucked up on meth and hitting boards with a crowbar. So, again, no real damage to property and no violence against a human. And then the third person had stolen $70 from a grocery worth of items from a grocery store.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's like, yeah. Ooh, boy. Sure would be better if they were dying.
And this is what this is why it's one of the frustrating things too for me is seeing that framing of it, and I'm sure that this Rantz fellow, if it were not like a radio rant or whatever, if it was like a published piece, they would have shown the original mugshots of those people when they were originally arrested as the photo that you see of them. Because they're scary. The mugshots are scary, you see. So you gotta show those.
So you gotta show them at people at their worst. Mm-hmm. We need to take a really quick break. You know, for the products and services that, you know, drive this show. But then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about some of the protests we're seeing pop up around the country and what they are protesting, all of that stuff, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to
reopen the gyms,
take some meth, hit boards with a crowbar, and justify your incarceration and death by a virus in doing so, and also products.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
We are have become returned.
We are have become returned indeed.
It's nailing it.
As I alluded to before the break, I'm going to talk a little bit about the prison protests that we are seeing popping up. And to your point, Cody, yes, earlier on, people probably have heard about how jails are epicenters, truly epicenters for the outbreaks that we're seeing throughout America, not just because of the prisoners, although everybody should be caring about the fact that prisoners are being treated inhumanely, but also correctional officers, people that work in the facilities and then go home and spread the virus to the counties that they live in. So that's really important. And hopefully you guys have seen that and you are aware of the situation, just like nursing homes are also epicenters. Okay, getting off topic. But my problem is that the mainstream media has not and has never been good about covering protests around prisons. You know,
the lamestream greedia.
Well, huh? Thank
nailed
you.
Nailed it. Oh my God, okay. Cody. Okay. Wow.
I mean, we have seen hunger strikes at prisons in the past for conditions that we've talked about, you know, all sorts of strikes, and they never really break the surface of media coverage. And I find that that is true here. I mean, there are definitely little articles about all this stuff popping up, but I don't see very much top-down coverage of these things. So I've cobbled together something of a list here.
Oh, that's good. I want to also just real, like, that on that point, like, they can't get enough of covering the protests of the people who want to go to the
right,
gym.
Right, exactly.
They are obsessed with the haircut people, but they can't bring themselves to do more than a minute on, like, on these, or even just like nurses and doctors protesting. There's so many other protests going on that aren't just a bunch of weirdos who want to get a fucking haircut.
Right,
it's very frustrating.
Yeah, they're also not covering. Yeah, yeah, there. It's frustrating. We're all agreed on that.
We agree. It's frustrating.
Yeah, it's settled.
But that's why we're talking about it here today. And I assume that the majority of our listeners care about the conditions these people are living through. But if you don't, at least care about the fact this is a very compelling argument that our country will not have this under control until we figure out how to handle the outbreaks in prisons as well. Okay, cool. So some of the places that have had protests. In April, more than 100 prisoners at Monroe Prison in Washington State protested after 6 prisoners and 5 staff members were diagnosed with COVID-19. From what I understand, a couple of fire alarms were set off, and then the buildings were evacuated, leading to the inmates sitting in a field, some of them in masks, protesting the lack of attention being paid to the situation. Eventually, the infected prisoners were moved to isolation units. So that's something, although also a thing. Here in California.
Right, isolation units.
I don't know what that means. And then the official word from the prison is the situation is under control. Okay? Mm-hmm.
Don't worry, we put them in solitary. Great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here in California, citizens organized a protest outside of San Quentin, which is personally important to me. I do not have a family member in San Quentin currently, but I have had a family member in San Quentin in the past for a long time. It was a horrifying experience. They were drug charges and, you know, because of other things ends up there. It's a whole thing. But anyway, that to me stood out because I have spent a lot of time worrying about a loved one who has been incarcerated specifically there. Anyway, organizers respected social distancing by using a car caravan to demonstrate on Saturday. You know, they would circle around, you know, honking their horns, protesting the conditions in there. They were also calling for prisoners who are over the age of 60 to be released. But yeah, there have been similar car protests like that all over the states. In Indiana, back in April, organizers circled Westville Correctional Facility after 143 inmates and 36 correctional officers tested positive for coronavirus in Raleigh, North Carolina, just this past weekend. Another socially distant protest was organized. Cars circled the central prison, honking horns, and other people marched on foot carrying signs. This is from a local news station there. Julie Schneider, organizer of the protest, joined the dozens of people who took part in the social distance protest in their vehicles as others held up signs while walking around the prison. She and others demanded an end to solitary confinement practices and improved food and medical treatment during the coronavirus outbreak. Over years and years, what we've seen in DPS facilities is systemic ignoring of any kind of human rights. So that happened there. There were also similar protests also in North Carolina and Goldsboro. In Cleveland, actually, City Councilman Bashir Jones took part in a COVID-19 protest outside the Marion Correctional Institution. They have over more than 2,000 infected inmates and over 175 staff members.
Wow.
With coronavirus as of early May. Marion is considered one of the hardest hit COVID-19 hotspots in the nation. That's both believable and wildly unbelievable. You know, I mean, this is an enormous outbreak. Again, pointing to what I'd said earlier, it doesn't stay contained in the prison. It goes out to the community. Gosh, there are so many more. They're in Portland, in San Diego, in Florida. It's just these are not stories that many people are aware of and tracking or even know are happening so that they could go and join in the protests. You know what I mean? And that leads me to ICE facilities. Detainees at several ICE facilities have gone on strike to demand sanitary supplies. And apparently in some places it's been sort of effective. Federal judges in California and Pennsylvania have ordered ICE to release several detainees who have sued. And there are also lawsuits happening in other states, though I'm not clear where they stand at this point. But it's very case by case. At the Stewart Detention Center, which is a privately run ICE facility in Georgia, there have been some unsuccessful examples of inmates protesting their treatment during the pandemic. Apparently, sick patients were being ignored. The problems weren't being addressed. And this one I'm going to read from is from The Intercept. Carlos was on his bed feeling sick when he turned to look out the window and saw a group of detainees running out a side door leading to a recreation yard. Several correctional officers were giving chase. At first, Carlos thought that there was a fire, but then he saw correctional staff use pepper spray on the detainees. Daniel, another detainee whose name has also been changed, saw it all happen from a unit across the hall. "People were asking for medical attention for some of the sick people in here," Daniel said. "But because they, the staff, didn't pay attention, they began protesting. They started placing sheets on the windows and doors," Daniel said. "The correctional office began deploying gas, throwing detainees on the floor, taking them in handcuffs to," he assumed, "solitary confinement," or as they called it, the hole. Also in this article, they explain that there is a special unit of correctional officers tasked with suppressing detainee disturbances. Akin to a SWAT team, the pepper spraying unit is known as the Special Operations Response Team, or SORT. The SORT unit, which has not previously been reported on, is trained to use riot shields, helmets, pepper spray, and pepper ball ammunition. The whole article is pretty ghoulish. Apparently, this use of force has happened twice against prisoners protesting coronavirus. And both times, correctional officers have gone on and like celebrated their use of force and stuff on social media posts, also from the article. The posts in aggregate gives a series of snapshots of the SORT team's actions against the protesting detainees. In one social media post, a SORT officer said he shot all the detainees in sight with pepper ball projectiles. It was, he said, Call of Duty mode, referring to a violent first-person video game series
awesome.
About going to war. It's pretty yes. horrifying.
Cool way to view things.
Like one yeah. of those times in Call of Duty where you fire into a crowd of unarmed people with pepper spray paintballs. Cool.
Yeah, and again, so what are the things that they're protesting? They seem pretty reasonable to me. That conditions prisoners are being held in are improved, that they have access to medical care, you know, that they're not treating sick patients or isolating them in many cases. And I don't mean putting them in solitary confinement. I mean removing them from a crowded cell block. And as we've alluded to, also for the releasing of inmates to reduce the number of incarcerated individuals, especially people that do not need to be there, you know, for a variety of reasons. If we're like being realistic, like, do they deserve to be given a death sentence for their marijuana charges from 15 years ago?
Yeah, and that's I want to
up for debate.
I want to comment
debate,
on that,
Katie.
Because a number of people have had their lesser sentences become death sentences,
and I'm about to get to that. In March, William Barr actually ordered officials running federal prisons to immediately maximize the release of prisoners to home confinement, you know, to help prevent the spread, and, you know, urged them to focus on the most vulnerable people in facilities, such as elderly people. And that's a fine. That's a good move, you know, somewhat surprising from them, but it hasn't really moved the needle. I mean, you can push back on this, but from what I'm looking at, this only applies to about 2,000 of the 170,000 inmates in the federal correction system.
Yeah.
And the majority of the over 2 million prisoners currently being held in the United States are, you know, state or local level.
Yeah.
So that leaves the decision of what to do with the majority of the prisoners at the discretion of local governments and governors, which I know you've prepared some stuff on, Robert.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to talk in the context of people having their sentences turned into death sentences. I wanted to talk about Ephraim Stutzen. Stutzen was convicted for selling cocaine. He served 27 years in Lompoc Prison in California. And he was released on April 1st. Within hours of getting off of his bus in San Bernardino, he was hospitalized for COVID-19, and he was dead 5 days later. And his sister says that, he told her as he was in his last days in prison that he started to get sick. He was not released then, even though it would have improved his chances to have immediately been released to a hospital.
Yeah.
Instead, he spent days sick in prison and then was released and died immediately upon coming back out into the world for the first time in almost 30 years. And there's a number of stories like that. It's horrible. Yeah,
and that's a whole other thing. Like, even in releasing a lot of these people, if we're to do that, like, a lot of them don't have those connections in the real world anymore.
Nope.
So what do they do and where do they go?
I mean, it's the same thing with the story that you talked about earlier with the few inmates that have committed crimes, stole some food, you know, or got chased by the cops and arrested because they didn't have a valid driver's license.
Right, tried to get somewhere, needed food. Like, that's...
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying we should be going and stealing food, but you can understand.
Too late, Katie. It's too late. You've said it.
Yes, steal food. And, you know, while you're at it, hit some boards with a crowbar while on methamphetamine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All good calls. I wanted to talk about some of the governors that we've been celebrating recently for their relative competence in the face of the COVID-19 epidemic. Because Cuomo is a good example. So he's enjoys something like 80% popularity right now.
The villain from The Mask, Governor Cuomo.
Is he? Wait, what?
No, but look up the
Google
photo.
Google it. It's a thing.
Oh, no. Okay. That makes sense. Because he is essentially, I believe he would fight, I don't know. I don't remember much. I don't remember anything about The Mask, Cody, other than Jim Carrey's face is green. And he has that big comedy gun. It's like a Looney Tune, right?
Yeah, it's smoking.
And wasn't in the actual comics that it's based on, wasn't he like a horrible rapist murderer?
Yeah, it's way worse.
Much darker.
It's not great in the movie either. Like most Jim Carrey movies, I guess, of that era in retrospect. But.
Yeah, we let him get away with a lot in the 90s. But yeah, speaking of getting away with a lot.
But moving on.
Back to Governor
Andrew Cuomo.
Cuomo.
Like Stanley Yelnats, he is getting away with a lot. As you pointed out, you know, Jim Carrey was able to get away with a lot in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. We all as a society decided that
He said, somebody stop me. And then we said, no.
No, 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 we won't.
We were like, no, go on, please.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. And his, if you rewatch old Jim Carrey movies, with the exception of Ace Ventura 2, they're all monstrous, and the characters that we're supposed to identify with do horrible things, and we just let Jim Carrey get away with it because he was really good at making that one face and pretending to talk with his butt, and it was a simpler time, and we all decided that was okay. And in a similar manner, Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York City has been allowed to get away with some horrific actions because he's doing the gubernatorial equivalent of talking with his butt in a funny ha-ha movie, which is, I guess, talk like an adult. I don't know. It breaks down here, but you know what doesn't break down are the products and services that support this podcast. So we're going to talk about Cuomzy, but first, here's ads.
He's not even gubernatorial. The Cuomo brother.
I've got a joke. Gubernatorial, more like goober, you know?
Booger.
Ads!
Go to
there. These are the kind of jokes you don't get with NPR podcasts.
Boom.
Bunch of hacks.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
So we talked earlier in the episode about how old people, when released from prison, even if they're released from violent crimes, are very unlikely to reoffend for a variety of reasons, including, and this is like, again, it's one of the things that it's hard to get a lot of people on board with, because you hear like someone was jailed because they were part of a robbery where someone got murdered. And the argument is always like, okay, well, that other person, you know, never gets a chance for justice. And it's like, yeah, you know, that's fair. It's an unjust universe. But is it really better to just like lock them up for forever? Even though, like, we all can acknowledge that none of us are the same person we were at 20. And maybe a 60-year-old who's been in prison for 40 years should get a chance to be a different person than we were at 19 when they committed armed robbery or whatever. I don't know. That's kind of my feeling on the matter. But
what a messed up view of the world, Robert.
Yeah, it was not.
It really depends on their race, Robert, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it
was not. Oh, I hated
not,
saying that.
No, but it's true. It was not the opinion of Governor Andrew Cuomo in 2012 that older people should be released, maybe after spending decades in prison on good behavior. So in 2012, Valerie Gator was New York State's longest serving incarcerated woman. She committed a crime when she was 21 years old. She participated in the deaths of an elderly couple. I believe it was during a robbery gone wrong. And it was a pretty horrific crime. She was also 21 years old. And over the next almost 40 years in prison, she took significant steps to change herself into a better person. She earned multiple college degrees. She became a mentor to other prisons. She developed programs to assist in the rehabilitation. And her programs have earned her a number of awards from different national organizations because they helped reduce recidivism and help other prisoners to get out and rebuild their lives.
Counterpoint, how dare she?
You would consider her the model of what we would hope for in our prison system. You would hope that like this would be the goal, right? That somebody who committed a horrible crime when they were very young over the course of 39 years in prison could change into a multiple degree holder who develops programs that help hundreds of other people escape their youthful horrors and live lives.
That's the goal. Also, just to interject, we've used the word recidivism a couple times, and just in case you don't know, that is the tendency of a criminal incarcerated person to reoffend.
Wow, yeah. Thanks, Mom.
So she applied for clemency in 2012 and had a number of times because she was an old person and didn't want to die in prison, and because a hell of a lot of people thought that she deserved another chance after spending decades proving that she deserved another chance. And Andrew Cuomo personally denied her clemency application.
Cool.
In 2019, the New York State Legislature considered an elder parole measure, State Bill 2144. This would have allowed incarcerated older people to appear before a parole board for a chance at release at age 55 after serving 15 or more years in prison. And this was also voted down by the state legislature.
Excellent.
So, yeah, Miss Gator died September 3rd, 2019. So before COVID-19 hit, she died in a New York State prison, having never tasted free air again. So that's
heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's a bummer. It's also worth noting that while Cuomo did order the release of 1,100 people who were held up on parole violations and has released a number of older nonviolent offenders, he's repeatedly insisted that people who are incarcerated on some sort of violent crime not be released regardless of their age. And he also insisted that state correction officers not be allowed to wear masks until April 6th. That was when the state of New York finally allowed corrections officers to wear masks on the job, which probably contributed to the fact that a number of correction officers have died in the state of New York.
Could you explain the reasoning behind that?
I really don't.
What?
It's very dumb.
It's baffling to me that would even be like.
Yeah. So basically, before April 2nd, there was a directive from the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision that prohibited employees from wearing masks, quote, unless medically necessary for the job and the area they work in. And for whatever reason,
this.
Yeah, for whatever reason, that didn't apply in a pandemic. Basically, there was a lot of quibbling going on about whether or not every individual needed to wear a mask for their specific point in the job.
Wow.
And like, rather than just being sane about it and being like, OK, well, you know, maybe when there's a pandemic, everyone needs to wear a mask all the time. And they quibbled about like who needed to. And then 56 officers and sergeants got COVID-19. Yeah, it's a bummer. It is dumb. It just seems like a bureaucratic rule that was in place and didn't get released. Like April 2nd is real late for that to be dealt with.
Yeah.
And yeah. A lot of guards and a lot of prisoners, and we'll never know how many prisoners got sick as a result of this.
They won't even know.
They don't even know. So, yeah, it's part of this thing. Like Cuomo has, there's other criticisms that have nothing to do with the prison system to make about Cuomo and his response to COVID-19. But it is like really frustrating to me that he's getting pointed out as like, you know, taking this logical and fact and medicine based approach to the virus. And that's true in some places, but it's certainly not true of how prisons were handled, were treated in New York, of how and New York prisoners and guards, they were essentially like allowed to like it was allowed to spread almost unchecked. The general public in New York State received 4 times the number of tests per capita compared to inmates in prisons, even though, again, as we've discussed, inmates as individual people, because of the higher rate of illness among them, are more likely to be vulnerable to the coronavirus. And because of just the way prisons work, it's more likely to spread there. 1/4 the number of testing per capita, which is a very direct way of saying that Andrew Cuomo thinks that incarcerated people are less people and thus less worthy of having resources spent on them and less worthy of their lives being protected than people who are not incarcerated, which unfortunately a lot of Americans agree with. And there's this nasty thing related to the American puritanical streak, which is a big thing in this country, whereas this revulsion Americans have at the idea that a prisoner, that we are more revolted by the idea that a couple of guilty people might go free than the idea of a lot of basically decent people not continue to be punished. One of the things that I think best illustrates the toxicity of this kind of like this cruelty streak towards prisoners in American culture is the case of Willie Horton. So Willie Horton is a convicted, he's still alive today, he's a convicted American felon who was serving a life sentence for murder, a murder he committed in 1974. He was furloughed under a program that the state of Massachusetts stated, which allowed like prisoners to be essentially let out on the weekends if they met certain conditions. And he was furloughed in 1986, and in 1987, he twice raped a woman after pistol whipping, knifing, binding, and gagging her fiancé. It was a horrific crime, and it was used by the Bush campaign in 1988 to run against Michael Dukakis, who had been the governor of Massachusetts when this program was instituted. And they made a big deal about the weekend passes that prisoners were being allowed. And the idea was that, see, these Democrats tried to take it easy on a prisoner and this woman got raped. And like, that's a means that we should never, we should, like, it's always a bad idea to even consider easing up on any of these people and trying to rehabilitate them. And this is behind why people like Cuomo and people like Governor Inslee of Washington, why they have all made such a point of saying no one who is in for any kind of a violent offense is going to be considered for release. And it's because of the Willie Horton effect. It's because that this is like widely considered to be one of the things, if not the major thing, that cost Dukakis the 88 election. And one of the most infuriating things about the Willie Horton effect is that the Massachusetts furlough program existed to help reduce recidivism. And by some accounts, it had a 99% success rate. This was an extremely successful program when it came towards actually helping to reintegrate prisoners into society and allow them to rebuild their lives and exist in the future as a person who does not hurt people. It was extremely successful. The program was canceled as a result of this.
That one example of it going south is the only thing that people focus on instead of the positive impact.
Yeah, and it's the same thing you see with that Rants guy I talked about earlier, where, like, you know, you have this program to release people to try and stop the number of people dying from COVID-19, and immediately right-wing commentators are looking for every example of a crime committed by one of them. And so you've got, you know, 1,000 people released, and 3 of them committed minor fucking crimes, and we're gonna hammer this home. And these liberal governors, because most of them are pretty fundamentally cowards, are going to... They respond to that. None of them want to get Willie Hortoned.
Absolutely. It's the same thing we saw for the past few years with Dreamers.
Yeah.
And like, it's the way, just the way they talk. Like, okay, well, here's one, and they're bad. Therefore, it's why the president got away, even though like people got pissed. It's why he gets away with talking about like the animals and stuff like that.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's the same thing you see with, like, Syrian refugees and particularly Germany, mm-hmm. where, like, it's a big thing on the right to point out, like, look, you know, this guy was a refugee and he committed a rape, this guy was a refugee and he committed rape, and it's like, yeah, they let 1 million people into the country, some of them are going to be rapists. Yes.
Yeah.
When you take a million Americans, some of them will be rapists. Like, especially if it's Hollywood. And that doesn't mean that everyone else should be. Yeah. It's frustrating, but it's also incredibly easy to, because you can't argue against it, right? Like, if you're arguing in favor of prison furloughs, and the other person just has to bring up the case of one furloughed prisoner who committed a rape, you can't. There's no argument against that. I mean, there is a logical argument, which is that, okay, but what about all these thousands of people who are now living lives and contributing to society and who are back with their family members? And, like, what about, mm-hmm. like they matter too, but it's not something you can actually win in a rhetorical sense. And the biggest bummer about this is that from a perspective of actually winning re-election and from a perspective of actually, like, maintaining and holding their political power, I suspect all of these governors are making the right decision, which I think is the morally wrong decision, but I think it will work. Yeah, because Americans fucking hate incarcerated people.
They really do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For hating incarcerated people so much, we sure do make a lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all part of a much bigger conversation about prisons in general, which I think we should do at some point. You know, I'm very interested in the prison abolition movement versus prison reform, you know, because it's hard to say abolish prison when there's, you know, so many people that there are a lot of violent offenders or people that the general population would not be quick to saying, yes, let's let them free. It's complicated. But prison in general, there's so many issues that I have. And when people do go out, how they're not get out, they're not set up for success. They're not set up to be reintegrated.
We've just got such a gnarled view of freedom and humanity and, like...
Yeah. Ugh.
I'll share another personal story. My loved one that was in San Quentin while they were there, you know, drug charges and everything was started on antidepressants. And when he was released, they refused to give him his antidepressants or even a prescription. And he was released without health insurance, without anything. And, you know, with drug situations, like a lot of that has to do with depression and mental illness. And of course, it didn't take long for him to be back in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no support system. We fought to try to get him his medications and we couldn't get it.
And one of the reasons why, because one of the point you're making that's really good, Katie, is that when these people get out, they don't get out. They're not released with the things they need to take care of themselves or with an ability to take care of themselves. And that increases recidivism, like that guy who winds up shoplifting from a Fred Meyer because he just got out of jail during a pandemic and he can't get a job and he needs food.
Mm-hmm.
And then he becomes fuel for the right wing grist mill. And it's the same, like part of the reason the furlough program was so successful is that by letting these people out on the weekends, they're able to maintain relationships with family and friends.
Right.
And one of the number one factors that determines whether or not a criminal will, after being released from prison, will commit more crimes is whether or not they have a support network. It's all
wild.
Difficult to be released into the same community that you that you were in prior to being incarcerated. So if you are a drug addict and you're released into the same environment that you were before and you don't have that support system, what support system do you have? You have the people that you knew. And it's a real easy path back. But yes, having that furlough program, I imagine, yet you can strengthen bonds, reconnect with family members. You can also start to test the waters of being back in public. And figuring out what your boundaries are or how it feels to be out there. Do you know what I mean? It's a gradual reintroduction.
Yeah, it's jarring. It's a different world. And mm-hmm. On theme with our title of the show and the recent episode
show
we've
itself.
Done, we are ending this episode on a collective sigh.
No, actually, we're not. I have something to say.
Yay.
As Cody mentioned earlier in the episode, later this week, we will be releasing an interview we did with some organizers in Michigan who have been fighting this issue.
Yeah, the group is No Detention Centers in Michigan, and they're specifically protesting against the opening of private for-profit they're organizing against a recently opened private for-profit immigration prison in Baldwin, Michigan, owned and operated by the GEO Group. The GEO Group. So they're pro, and these are immigrant detention centers for non-U.S. citizens who have committed crimes. And they're as you can imagine, pretty brutal places.
Absolutely.
We'll hear from them later this week.
And they've been experiencing, we all heard those stories, I think, maybe not. Who can assume what people have seen in all of this chaos? A lot of people in ICE detention facilities have been uprooted and sent across this country to other facilities. And there's a lot of stuff happening there. But I say this to also mention that point that they made, and I'd like to make now, is that you can find local groups that are organizing to fight this. And I encourage you to do that, to look up the prisons near you in your county and see what efforts are being done, because that would be a good way to channel your frustration right now. Positive note achieved.
Nailed it.
Love it.
You did it. Excellent. Spectacular. Cool. Marvelous.
You guys can check us out online at Worst Year Pod on Twitter and on Instagram. And you could follow us all as well. I'm sure you have those handles.
Yeah. Google our names and the word Twitter. You'll find us.
And I guess that does it for us today. We're going to go have better Mondays, I think. And I hope you guys do as well, except it'll probably be Wednesday. Have a better Wednesday.
Have a good whatever day.
I tried. Yes. Daniel?
Lovely.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.